those feelings?
The first time I saw the capital, I was very young. I'd never seen a waterfall before. I thought they were so beautiful. I never thought that one day I'd live in the palace. Well, tell me, did you dream of power and politics when you were a little girl?
Again, Padme had to laugh aloud.
No, that was the last thing I thought of.
She could feel the wistfulness creeping into her, the memories of those long-ago days before her innocence had been shattered by war, and even more so, by the constant deceptions and conniving of politics. She could hardly believe that she was opening up to Anakin like this.
My dream was to work in the refugee relief movement. I never thought of running for elected office, but the more history I studied, the more I realized how much good politicians could do. So when I was 8, I joined the Apprentice Legislators, which is like making a formal announcement that you're entering public service here in Naboo. From there, I went on to become a senatorial advisor and attacked my duties with such a passion that before I knew it, I was elected queen. Padme looked at Anakin and shrugged, trying not to throw all humility away. Partly because I scored so high on my education certificate, she explained. But for the most part, my ascent was because of my conviction that reform was possible. The people of Naboo embraced that dream wholeheartedly, so much so that my age was hardly an issue in the campaign. I wasn't the youngest queen ever elected, but now that I think back on it, I'm not sure I was old enough. She paused and locked stares with Anakin. I'm not sure I was ready.
The people you serve thought you did a good job, Anakin reminded her. I heard they tried to amend the Constitution so that you could stay in office.
Popular rule is not democracy, Anakin. It gives the people what they want, not what they need. And truthfully, I was relieved when my 2 terms were up. Padme chuckled as she continued, adding emphasis. So were my parents. They worried about me during the blockade and couldn't wait for it all to be over. Actually, I was hoping to have a family by now. She turned away a bit, feeling her face flushing. How could she be so open to him and so quickly?
He was not a longtime friend, she reminded herself, but the warning sounded hollow in her thoughts.
She looked back at Anakin and she felt so at ease, so comfortable with him, almost as if they had been friends for all their lives. My sister has the most amazing, wonderful kids. Her eyes were sparkling, she knew, but she blinked the emotion away, as Padme had often blinked away her personal desires, for the sake of what she perceived to be the greater good. But when the Queen asked me to serve as senator, I couldn't refuse her, she explained.
I agree, Anakin replied. I think the Republic needs you. I'm glad you chose to serve. I feel things are going to happen in our generation that will change the galaxy in profound ways.
A Jedi premonition? Padme kidded. Anakin laughed.
A feeling, he explained, or tried to explain, for it was obvious that he wasn't quite sure what he was trying to say.
It just seems to me as if it's all grown stale, as if something has to happen.
I think so, too, Padme put in sincerely.
They had arrived at the great doors of the palace and paused to take in the beautiful scene. Unlike most of Coruscant's buildings, which seemed to have been designed with utter efficiency in mind, this structure was more akin to the Jedi Temple, an understanding that aesthetics were important, that form went hand in hand with purpose. Padme knew her way about the place, obviously, and she was well known by almost all of the people within. And so the two walked along easily to the throne room, where they were announced at once. Smiling faces greeted them. Cio Bibble, Padme's dear friend and her trusted advisor when she was queen, stood by the throne, flanking Queen Jamila, as he had so often flanked Padme. He hadn't aged much over the last years. His white hair and beard still distinguished and perfectly coiffed. His eyes still full of that intensity that Padme so loved. Beside him, Jamila looked every bit the part of queen. She wore a great headdress and flowing embroidered robes, the same type of outfit Padme had worn for so very long. And the senator thought that Jamila looked at least as regal in them as she had. Handmaidens, advisors, and guards were all about. And Padme reflected that one of the side effects of being queen, and not a pleasant one, was that one was never allowed to be alone. Queen Jamila, standing perfectly straight so that her headdress did not topple,
rose and walked over to take Padme's hand.
"We've been worried about you. I'm so glad you're here, Padme," she said,
her voice rich and with a southeastern accent that made her enunciate the consonants powerfully.
"Thank you, Your Highness. I only wish I could have served you better by staying on Coruscant for the vote."
"Supreme Chancellor Palpatine has explained it all," C.O. Bibble interjected. "Returning home was the only real choice you could have made."
Padme gave him a resigned nod. Still, being sent home to Naboo bothered her. She had worked so very hard against the creation of a Republic army.
"How many systems have joined Count Dooku and the Separatists?"
Queen Jamila asked bluntly. She had never been one for small talk.
"Thousands," Padme answered.
"And more are leaving the Republic every day. If the Senate votes to create an army, I'm sure it's going to push us into civil war."
C.O. Bibble punched his fist into his open hand.
"It's unthinkable," he said,
gnashing his teeth with every word.
"There hasn't been a full-scale war since the formation of the Republic."
"Do you see any way through negotiations to bring the Separatists back into the Republic?"
Jamila asked, staying calm despite C.O. Bibble's obvious agitation. "Not if they feel threatened." It amazed Padme to realize how secure she was in these estimations. She felt as if she was beginning to fully understand the nuances of her position, as if she could trust her instincts implicitly. And all of her talents would be needed, she knew.
"The Separatists don't have an army, but if they are provoked, they will move to defend themselves. I'm sure of that. And with no time or money to build an army, my guess is they will turn to the Commerce Guild or the Trade Federation for help."
"The armies of commerce," Queen Jamila echoed with anger and distaste. All on Naboo knew well the problems associated with such free-ranging groups. The Trade Federation had nearly brought Naboo to its knees, and would have, had it not been for the heroics of Amidala, a pair of Jedi, a young Anakin, and the brave flying of the dedicated Naboo pilots. Even that would not have been enough, had not Queen Amidala forged an unexpected alliance with the heroic Gungans.
"Why has nothing been done in the Senate to restrain them?"
"I'm afraid that, despite the Chancellor's best efforts, there are still many bureaucrats, judges, and even senators on the payrolls of the guilds," Padme admitted.
"Then it is true that the guilds have moved closer to the Separatists, as we suspected,"
Queen Jamila reasoned. C.O. Bibble punched his open palm again, drawing their attention.
"It's outrageous," he said. "It's outrageous that after all those hearings and four trials in the Supreme Court, Newt Gunray is still the Viceroy of the Trade Federation. Do those money mongers control everything?"
"Remember, Counselor, the courts were able to reduce the Trade Federation's armies,"
Jamila reminded, again holding her calm and controlled voice.
"That's a move in the right direction."
Padme winced, knowing that she had to report honestly.
"There are rumors, Your Highness, that the Federation's army was not reduced as they were ordered."
Clearing his throat, Anakin Skywalker stepped forward.
"The Jedi have not been allowed to investigate," he explained. "It would be too dangerous for the economy, we were told."
Queen Jamila looked to him and nodded, looked back to Padme, then squared her shoulders and firmed her jawline, looking regal in the ornate raiments. Very much the planetary ruler, obedient to the Republic.
"We must keep our faith in the Republic," she declared. "The day we stop believing democracy can work is the day we lose it."
"Let's pray that day never comes," Padme quietly answered. "In the meantime, we must consider your own safety," Queen Jamila said, and she looked to C.O. Bibble, who motioned to the attendants. All of them, advisors, attendants, and handmaidens, bowed and quickly left the room. C.O. Bibble moved near to Anakin, the appointed protector, then paused, waiting for all of the others to be gone. At last he spoke.
"What is your suggestion, Master Jedi?"
"Anakin's not a Jedi yet, Counselor," Padme interrupted.
"He's still a Padawan learner. I was thinking..."
"Hey, hold on a minute!"
Anakin cut her short, his eyes narrowed, brow furrowed, obviously agitated and put off by her dismissal.
"Excuse me,"
Padme shot right back, not backing down from Anakin's imposing glare.
"I was thinking I would stay in the Lake Country. There are some places up there that are very isolated.
"Excuse me," Anakin said, giving it right back to her in words and in tone. "I am in charge of security here, m'lady."
Padme started to fight back, but she noted then the exchange of suspicious looks between C.O. Bibble and Queen Jamila. She and Anakin should not be fighting in this manner in public, she realized. Not without making others believe that something might be going on between them. She calmed down and softened her expression and her voice. "Anakin, my life is at risk, and this is my home. I know it very well. That is why we're here. I think it would be wise for you to take advantage of my knowledge in this instance."
Anakin looked around at the two onlookers and then back at Padme, and the hardness melted from his expression.
"Sorry, m'lady."
"She's right," an obviously amused C.O. Bibble said, taking Anakin's arm. "The Lake Country is the most remote part of Naboo. Not many people up there, and a clear view of the surrounding terrain. It would be an excellent choice, a place where you would have a much easier time protecting Senator Amidala."
"Perfect," Queen Jamila agreed. "It's settled, then." Padme could tell from the way Anakin was looking at her that he wasn't overly pleased. She offered an innocent shrug in response. "Padme," Queen Jamila went on, "I had an audience with your father yesterday. I told him what was happening. He hopes you will visit your mother before you leave. Your family's very worried about you." How could they not be, Padme thought. And it pained her to consider that the dangers her strong positions were bringing to her were affecting other people whom she loved. How could they not? It was a perfect reminder of why family and public service didn't usually mix. Padme Amidala had made a conscious and definitive choice. Public service or family. Some in Naboo juggled the two, but Padme had always known that such a dual role as wife, perhaps even mother, and senator, would not do well for family or state. She hadn't been worried about her own safety at all through these trials, willing to make whatever sacrifices were necessary. But now, suddenly, she had to remember that her choices and positions could affect others on a very personal level as well. She wore no smile as she walked with Anakin, C.O. Bibble, and Queen Jamila out of the throne room and down the palace's main staircase. Chapter 13. The largest room in the vast Jedi temple on Coruscant was the Hall of the Archives. Lighted computer panels stretched out in long, long lines of bluish dots along the walls, running so far that a person viewing them from one end of the room would see them converging at the other end. And throughout were the images of Jedi's past and present, groups of sculpted busts done in white stone by many of the finest artisans of Coruscant. Obi-Wan Kenobi stood at one of these busts, studying it, touching it, as if examining the facial features of the person depicted would give him some insight to the man's motivations. There weren't many visitors in the archives today. There rarely were more than a few, and so the Jedi expected that his call to Madame Jocasta Nu, the Jedi archivist, would be answered shortly. He stood patiently studying the strong features on the bust, the high and proud cheekbones, the meticulous hairstyle, the eyes wide and alert. Obi-Wan hadn't known this man, this legend, Count Dooku, very well. But he had seen him on occasion, and he knew that this bust captured the essence of Dooku perfectly. There was an intensity about the man as palpable as that which had sometimes surrounded Master Qui-Gon, especially when Qui-Gon had found a particularly important cause. Qui-Gon would go against the Jedi Council when he felt that he was right, as he had done with Anakin some 10 years earlier. Before the Council had agreed to recognize that the boy's special circumstances, the incredible force potential, and the promise that he might be the one spoken of in prophecy. Yes, Obi-Wan had seen this kind of intensity in Qui-Gon on occasion. But what he knew of Dooku was that, unlike Qui-Gon, the man had never been able to shut it off, had always been stomping around, chewing over an issue. The lights in his eyes were ever-burning fires. But Dooku had taken it to extremes, and dangerous ones, Obi-Wan realized. He had left the Jedi Order, had walked out on his calling and on his peers. Whatever problems Dooku must have seen,
He should have recognized that he could better repair them by remaining within the Jedi family.
"Did you call for assistance?"
came a stern voice behind Obi-Wan, drawing him from his thoughts. He turned to see Madame Jocasta Nu standing beside him, her hands folded together before her, practically disappearing within the folds of her Jedi robes. She was a frail-looking creature, quite elderly, and noting that brought a smile to Obi-Wan's face. How many younger and less experienced Jedi had looked upon that facade, the thin and wrinkled face and neck, the white hair tied tight, thinking that they could push the woman around, getting her to do their studying for them, only to encounter the truth that was Jocasta Nu. She was a firebrand, that weak facade hiding her true strength and determination. Jocasta Nu had been the archivist for many, many years, and this was her place, her domain, her kingdom. Any Jedi coming in here, even the most exalted of Jedi masters, would play by the rules of Jocasta Nu, or they would surely face her wrath. "Yes, yes, I did," Obi-Wan finally managed to respond, realizing that Jocasta Nu was staring at him inquisitively, awaiting an answer. The old woman smiled and walked past him to regard the bust of Count Dooku.
"He has a powerful face, doesn't he?"
she commented, her quiet tone taking the tension out of the meeting.
"He was one of the most brilliant Jedi I have had the privilege of knowing."
"I never understood why he quit," Obi-Wan said, following Jocasta Nu's look to the bust. "Only 20 Jedi have ever left the Order."
"The lost 20," Jocasta Nu said with a profound sigh. "And Count Dooku was the most recent and the most painful. No one likes to talk about it. His leaving was a great loss to the Order."
"What happened?"
"Well, one might say he was a bit out of step with the decisions of the Council," the archivist replied. "Much like your old Master Qui-Gon."
Even though Obi-Wan had just been thinking the same thing, somewhat, to hear Jocasta Nu speak the word so definitively caught him off guard, and painted Qui-Gon in a more rebellious light than he had ever considered. He knew that his former master had his moments, of course, the greatest of those being the confrontations concerning Anakin, but he had never thought of Qui-Gon as that much of a rebel. Apparently, Jocasta Nu, who had her finger as squarely as anyone on the pulse of the Jedi Temple, did.
"Really?"
Obi-Wan prompted, wanting the information about Dooku, of course, but also hoping to garner some insight into his old and beloved master.
"Oh, yes, they were alike in many ways. Very individual thinkers. Idealists."
She stared at the bust intently, and it seemed to Obi-Wan as if she had suddenly gone far, far away.
"He was always striving to become a more powerful Jedi. He wanted to be the best. With a lightsaber, in the old style of fencing, he had no match. His knowledge of the Force was unique. In the end, I think he left because he lost faith in the Republic. He believed that politics were corrupt."
Jocasta Nu paused for a moment and looked at Obi-Wan, a very revealing expression that showed she did not think Dooku was out of step, as many of the others apparently did.
"And he felt that the Jedi betrayed themselves by serving the politicians," the archivist stated.
Obi-Wan blinked, soaking in the words. He knew that many, Qui-Gon included, even himself included at times, often felt the same way.
"He always had very high expectations of government," Jocasta Nu went on. "He disappeared for 9 or 10 years, then just showed up recently as the head of the Separatist movement."
"Interesting," Obi-Wan remarked, looking from the bust to the archivist. "I'm still not sure I understand."
"None of us does," Jocasta Nu replied,
her serious expression melting into a warm smile.
"Well, I'm sure you didn't call me over here for a history lesson. Are you having a problem, Master Kenobi?"
"Yes. I'm trying to find a planet system called Kamino. It doesn't seem to show up on any of the archive charts."
Kamino.
Jocasta Nu looked around, as if she was searching for the system right then and there.
It's not a system I'm familiar with. Let me see.
A few steps brought them to the computer screen where Obi-Wan had been searching. She bent low and pressed a couple of commands.
Are you sure you have the right coordinates?
According to my information, it should be in this quadrant somewhere, said Obi-Wan, just south of the Rishi Maze. A few more taps of the keyboard brought nothing more than a frown to Jocasta Nu's old and weathered face.
But what are the exact coordinates?
I only know the quadrant, Obi-Wan admitted, and Jocasta Nu turned up to regard him.
No coordinates? Sounds like the sort of directions you'd get from a street tout, some old miner or furbog trader.
All three, actually, Obi-Wan admitted with a grin.
Are you sure it exists?
Absolutely. Jocasta Nu sat back and rubbed a hand pensively over her chin.
Let me do a gravitational scan, she said,
as much to herself as to Obi-Wan. The star map hologram of the target quadrant went into motion after a few more keystrokes, and the pair studied the movements.
There are some inconsistencies here, the sharp archivist noted. Maybe the planet you're seeking was destroyed.
Wouldn't that be on record?
It ought to be, unless it was very recent,
Jocasta Nu replied. But she was shaking her head even as she spoke the words, not even convincing herself.
I hate to say it, but it looks like the system you're searching for doesn't exist.
That's impossible. Perhaps the archives are incomplete.
The archives are comprehensive and totally secure, my young Jedi,
came the imposing response. The archivist, stepping back from her familiarity with Obi-Wan, and assuming again the demeanor of Archive Kingdom ruler.
One thing you may be absolutely sure of. If an item does not appear in our records, it does not exist.
The two stared at each other for a long moment, Obi-Wan taking note that there wasn't the slightest tremor of doubt in Jocasta Nu's declaration. He looked back to the map, perplexed, caught within a seemingly unanswerable question. He knew that no one in the galaxy was more reliable for information than Dexter Jetster, unless that person was Jocasta Nu. And yet the two were obviously at odds here, concerning their information. Dexter had seemed every bit as certain of the origins of the saber dart as Jocasta Nu was now. Both couldn't be right. The puzzle of finding Senator Amidala's would-be assassin would not be easily solved, it seemed, and that troubled Obi-Wan Kenobi for many, many reasons. With Jocasta Nu's permission, the Jedi punched a few buttons on the keyboard, downloading the archive information on that region of the quadrant to a small hologlobe. Then, the item in hand, he left the area. But not without one long last look at the imposing bust of Count Dooku. Later on that day, Obi-Wan turned away from the archives and the analysis droids and turned within, to his own insights instead. He found a small comfortable room along the temple's grand balcony, one of many such rooms designed for quiet moments of Jedi reflection. A small fountain bubbled off to the side of him as he settled on a soft but firm mat and crossed his legs. The water trickled down to a bed of polished stones, making a delicate sound, a background noise, natural in its beauty and in the simplicity of its song. Before Obi-Wan, a painting of reds shifting and darkening to a deep crimson and then to black, a liberal representation of a cooling lava field hung on the wall, inviting him not to look into it, but to surround himself with it, both its image and the soft warmth and hissing sound, helping him to fall far away from his corporeal surroundings. There in his trance, Obi-Wan Kenobi sought his answers. He focused on the mystery of Kamino first, expecting that Dexter's analysis was correct. But why hadn't the system shown up in the archives? Another image invaded Obi-Wan's meditations as he tried to sort through that puzzle. An image of Anakin and Padme together on Naboo.
The Jedi Knight started, suddenly afraid that this was a premonition, and that some danger would visit his Padawan and the young senator. But no, he realized, settling back. No danger was about. The two were relaxed and at play. Obi-Wan's relief lasted only as long as it took him to realize that the continuing scene in his mind might be the most dangerous thing of all. He dismissed it, though, unsure if this was a premonition, an image of reality, or just his own fears playing out before him. Obi-Wan pointedly reminded himself that the sooner he solved the mystery of Kamino, the mystery of who so desperately wanted Amidala dead, the sooner he could return to Anakin and offer the proper guidance. The Jedi Knight focused again on the bust of Count Dooku, searching for insights, but for some reason, the image of Anakin kept becoming interposed with that of the renegade Count. Soon after, a frustrated and thoroughly bewildered Obi-Wan walked out of the small meditation chamber, shaking his head, and no more certain of anything than he had been when he had entered the place. His patience exhausted into frustration, the Jedi Knight decided to seek a higher authority, one wiser and more experienced. His short trip took him out of the temple proper and onto the veranda, and there he paused and watched, and in the innocent scene before him, found some relief from the frustration. Master Yoda was leading 20 of the youngest Jedi recruits, children only 4 or 5 years old, through their morning training exercises, battling floating training droids with miniature lightsabers. Obi-Wan recalled his own training. He couldn't see the eyes of the youngsters, for they wore protective full-face helmets, but he could well imagine the range of emotions playing out on their innocent faces. There would be intensity, and then great joy, whenever an energy bolt from a training droid was blocked. And that elation would inevitably dissipate in the next instant, when the joy brought distraction, and distraction allowed the next energy bolt to slip past and bring a sudden jolting sting. And those little bolts did sting, Obi-Wan remembered, as much physically as in pride. There was nothing worse than getting zapped, particularly in the backside. It always caused one to do a little hopping and twisting dance, which naturally made the embarrassment all the worse. Obi-Wan recalled that feeling vividly, recalled thinking that everyone in the courtyard was staring at him. The training could be humiliating. But it was also energizing, because with the failures would come the successes, each one building confidence, each one leading insights into the flowing beauty that was the Force, heightening the connection that separated a Jedi from the rest of the galaxy. To see Yoda leading the training this day, looking exactly as he had when he'd led Obi-Wan's training a quarter century before, brought a flush of warmth to the Jedi Knight.
"Don't think. Feel," Yoda instructed the group. "Be as one with the Force."
Obi-Wan, smiling, mouthed the exact words as Yoda finished.
"Help you, it will."
How many times he had heard that. He was still grinning widely when Yoda turned to him.
"Younglings, enough,"
the great Jedi Master commanded.
"A visitor we have. Welcome him."
20 little lightsabers clicked off and the students came to attention together, removing their helmets and tucking them properly under their left arms.
"Master Obi-Wan Kenobi," Yoda said,
keeping enough gravity in his voice so that the younglings wouldn't feel mocked.
"Welcome, Master Obi-Wan," the 20 called out together.
"I'm sorry to disturb you, Master," Obi-Wan said with a slight bow.
"What help to you can I be?"
Obi-Wan considered the question for a moment. He had specifically come out here looking for Yoda, but now, in seeing the diminutive master at his important work, he wondered if he had let his patience fall away too quickly. Was it his place to ask Yoda to help him with a mission that was his own responsibility? It didn't take long for Obi-Wan to dismiss the question. He was a Jedi Knight, Yoda a master, and his responsibilities and Yoda's were ultimately one and the same. He didn't expect Yoda could help him with this particular problem, but then again, Yoda had always been full of surprises, full of going far beyond any expectations.
"I'm looking for a planet described to me by an old friend," he explained,
and he knew that Yoda was absorbing every word. I trust him and the information he provided, but the system doesn't show up on the archive maps. As he finished, he showed Yoda that he had a hologlobe with him.
An interesting puzzle, Yoda answered. Lost a planet, Master Obi-Wan has. How embarrassing. How embarrassing. An interesting puzzle. Gather, younglings, around the map reader. Clear your minds and find Obi-Wan's wayward planet we will try.
They went into a room to the side of the veranda. A narrow shaft was set in the middle, with a hollow depression at the top. Off to the side, Obi-Wan took up the hologlobe, then moved and placed it in the hollow of the shaft. The shades closed as soon as he put it there, darkening the room, and a star map hologram appeared, glittering distinctly. Obi-Wan paused a moment before presenting his dilemma, allowing the younglings to get past the initial excitement. He watched with amusement as some reached up and tried to touch the projected starlights. Then, when all quieted, he walked into the middle of the projection. This is where it ought to be, he explained. Gravity is pulling all the stars in this area inward to this spot. There should be a star here, but there isn't.
Most interesting, Yoda said. Gravity silhouette remains, but the star and all its planets have disappeared. How can this be? Now, younglings, in your mind, what is the first thing you see? An answer? A thought? Anyone?
Obi-Wan took Yoda's quiet cue and paused then, watching the Jedi Master watch over his gathering. A hand went up. And while Obi-Wan felt the urge to chuckle at the idea of a youngling solving a riddle that had befuddled a trio of accomplished Jedi, including Yoda and Madame Jocasta Nu, he noted that Yoda was quite focused and serious. Yoda nodded to the student, who answered at once.
Because someone erased it from the archive memory.
That's right,
another of the children agreed at once.
That's what happened. Someone erased it.
If the planet blew up, the gravity would go away,
another one of the children called out. Obi-Wan stared blankly at the excited group, stunned, but Yoda only chuckled.
Truly wonderful the mind of a child is, he explained. Uncluttered. The data must have been erased.
Yoda started out of the room, and Obi-Wan moved to follow, flicking his hand as he passed the reader shaft, force-pulling the hologlobe back to his grasp and instantly dismissing the starry scene.
To the center of the pull of gravity go, and find your planet you will,
Yoda advised him.
But Master Yoda, who could have erased information from the archives? That's impossible, isn't it?
Dangerous and disturbing this puzzle is,
Yoda replied with a frown.
Only a Jedi could have erased those files. But who and why? Harder to answer. Meditate on this, I will. May the Force be with you.
1,000 questions filtered through Obi-Wan's mind, but he understood that Yoda had just dismissed him. They each had their riddles, it seemed. But at least now, Obi-Wan's path seemed much clearer before him. He gave a deferential bow, but Yoda, already back to his work with the children, didn't seem to notice. Obi-Wan walked away. Soon after, not wanting to waste a moment, Obi-Wan was out on the landing platform, standing beside his readied starfighter, a long and sleek Delta wing fighter of an Arrowhead design, with the cockpit set far aft. Mace Windu was there beside him, the tall and strong-featured master regarding Obi-Wan with his typically calm and controlled demeanor. There was something reassuring about Mace Windu, a sense of power and, even more than that, of destiny. Mace Windu had a way of silently assuring all those around him that things would work out as they were supposed to.
Be wary, he said to Obi-Wan, tilting his head back just a bit as he spoke.
a posture that made him seem all the more impressive.
This disturbance in the Force is growing stronger.
Obi-Wan nodded, though in truth, his concerns were more focused and tangible at that moment.
I'm concerned for my Padawan. He is not ready to be on his own.
Mace gave a nod, as if to remind Obi-Wan that they had covered this already.
He has exceptional skills, the Master replied. The Council is confident in its decision, Obi-Wan. Not all of the questions about him have been answered, of course, but his talents cannot be dismissed, and we are not disappointed in the progress he has made under your tutelage.
Obi-Wan considered the words carefully and nodded again, knowing that he was walking a fine line here. If he overstated his concerns about Anakin's temperament, he might be doing a great disservice to the Jedi and to the galaxy. And yet, if he let the magnitude of his assignment in training Anakin Skywalker bring him to silence on legitimate questions, then was he doing great harm?
If the prophecy is true, Anakin will be the one to bring balance to the Force, Mace finished.
But he still has much to learn. His skills have made him... well...
Obi-Wan paused, trying to walk that delicate line.
Arrogant. I realize now what you and Master Yoda knew from the beginning. The boy was too old to start the training, and...
The frown spreading on Mace Windu's face signaled Obi-Wan that he might be pushing a bit too hard here.
There's something else, Mace observed.
Obi-Wan took a deep and steadying breath.
Master, Anakin and I should not have been given this assignment. I'm afraid Anakin won't be able to protect the Senator.
Why?
He has an emotional connection with her. It's been there since he was a boy. Now he's confused and distracted.
As he spoke, Obi-Wan started toward his starfighter. He climbed up the cockpit ladder and into his seat.
So you have already stated, Mace reminded. And your concerns were weighed properly and did not change the decision of the Council. Obi-Wan, you must have faith that Anakin will take the right path.
It made sense, of course. If Anakin was to become a great leader, a creature of prophecy, then surely his character tests must be passed. Anakin was waging one of those tests right now, Obi-Wan knew, off in seclusion on a distant planet with a woman whom he loved too deeply. He had to be strong enough to pass that test. Obi-Wan just hoped that Anakin recognized the trial for what it was.
Has Master Yoda gained any insight as to whether or not this war will come about? He asked,
somewhat changing the subject, though he felt that it was all very connected.
Finding the assassin, making peace with the Separatists, all of these things would allow him to focus more closely on Anakin's training, and would keep things at a more even keel around the troubled Padawan.
Probing the dark side is a dangerous process, Mace stated. I know not when he will choose to begin, but when he does, it is quite possible that he will remain in seclusion for days.
Obi-Wan nodded his agreement, and Mace gave him a smile and a wave.
May the Force be with you.
Set the course to the hyperspace ring, R4, Obi-Wan instructed his astromech droid, an R4P unit that was hardwired into the left wing of the sleek starfighter. Silently, the Jedi Knight added to himself,
Let's get this thing moving.
Chapter 14. It was a scene of simplicity, of children playing and adults sitting quietly under the warm sun, or gossiping across neatly trimmed hedgerows. It was a scene of absolute normalcy for Naboo, but it was nothing like Anakin Skywalker had ever witnessed. On Tatooine, the houses were singular, out in the desert, or they were clustered tightly in cities like Mos Eisley, with its hustle and bustle and bright colors and brighter characters. On Coruscant, there were no streets like this one any longer. There were no hedgerows and trees lining the ground, just permacrete and old buildings and the gray foundations of the towering skyscrapers. People did not gossip, with children running carefree about them in either place. To Anakin, it was a scene of simple beauty.
He was back to wearing his Jedi robes, the peasant garb discarded. Padme walked alongside him in a simple blue dress that only seemed to enhance her beauty. Anakin kept glancing her way, stealing images of her to burn into his mind, to hold forever in a special place. She could be wearing anything, he realized, and still be beautiful. Anakin smiled as he recalled the ornate outfits Padme had often worn as Queen of Naboo. Huge gowns with intricate embroidery and studded with gemstones. Tremendous headpieces of plumes and swirls and curves and twists. He liked her better like this, he decided. All of the decorations of her queenly outfits had been beautifully designed, but still could only detract from the more beautifully designed Padme. Wearing a great headpiece only hid her silken brown hair. Painting her face in whites and bright red only hid her beautiful skin. The embroidery on the great gowns only blurred the perfection of her form. This was the way Anakin wanted to see her, where her clothing was just a finishing touch. "There's my house," Padme cried suddenly, startling Anakin from his pleasant daydreams. He followed her gaze to see a simple but tasteful structure, surrounded, like everything on Naboo, by flowers and vines and hedges. Padme started off immediately for the door, but Anakin didn't follow right away. He studied the house, every line, every detail, trying to see in it the environment that had produced her. She had told him many stories of her childhood in this house during their trip from Coruscant, and now he was replaying those tales, seeing them in context now that the yard was in view. "What?" Padme asked him from some distance ahead, when she noticed that he was not following. "Don't tell me you're shy." "No, but I..." The distracted Anakin started to answer, but he was interrupted by the squeals of two little girls running out from the yard toward his companion.
"Aunt Padme! Aunt Padme!"
Padme's smile went as wide as Anakin had ever seen it, and she rushed ahead, bending low to scoop the pair who looked to be no more than a few years old, one a bit taller than the other, into her arms. One had hair short and blonde and curly. The other, the older of the two, had hair that resembled Padme's.
"Ryu! Pooja!"
Padme cried, hugging them and twirling them about.
"I'm so happy to see you."
She kissed them both and set them down, then took them by the hand and led them toward Anakin. "This is Anakin. Anakin, this is Ryu and Pooja." The blush on the pair, as they shyly said hello, brought a burst of laughter from Padme and a smile to Anakin's face, though he was equally ill at ease as the two children. The girl's shyness lasted only as long as it took for them to notice the little droid rolling behind Anakin trying to catch up.
"R2!"
they shouted in unison. Breaking away from Padme, they rushed to the droid, leaping upon him, hugging him cheek to dome. And R2-D2 seemed equally thrilled, beeping and whistling as happily as Anakin had ever heard. Anakin couldn't help but be touched by the scene, a view of innocence that he had never known. Well, not never, he had to admit. There were times when Shmi had found some way to produce such moments of joy amid the drudgery that was life as a slave on Tatooine. In their own way, in that dusty, dirty, hot, and smelly place, Anakin and his mother had carved out a few instants of innocent beauty. Here, though, such moments seemed so much more the norm than the memorable exception. Anakin turned back to Padme to see that she was no longer looking his way, but had turned toward the house, where another woman, who looked very much like Padme, was approaching. Not exactly like Padme, Anakin noted. She was a little older, a little heavier, and a little more... worn was the only word he could think of, but not in a bad way. Yes, he could see it now, he thought, watching as she and Padme hugged tightly. This was whom Padme could become. More settled, more content, perhaps. Considering the amazing resemblance, Anakin was hardly surprised when Padme introduced the woman as her sister, Sola. "Mom and Dad will be so happy to see you," Sola said to Padme. "It's been a difficult few weeks." Padme frowned. She knew that word of the attempts on her life would have reached her parents' ears, and that was possibly the most disturbing thing of all to her.
Anakin saw it all in her face, and he understood it well, and he loved her all the more for that generosity. Padme wasn't really afraid of anything. She could handle the reality of her current situation, the reality of the fact that someone was trying to kill her, with determination and courage. But the one thing about it all that troubled her, aside from the political ramifications of such distractions, the ways they might weaken her position in the Senate, was the effect of such danger upon those she loved. He knew that she didn't want to bring pain to her family. Anakin, who had left his mother as a slave on Tatooine, could appreciate that. "Mom's making dinner," Solo explained, noting Padme's discomfort and generously changing the subject. "As usual, your timing is perfect." She started toward the house. Padme waited for Anakin to move beside her, then took his hand, looked up, smiled at him, and led him toward the door. R2-D2 rolled along right behind, with Ryu and Pooja bouncing all about him. The interior of the house was just as simply wonderful and just as full of life and soft color as was the yard. There were no glaring lights, no beeping consoles, or flickering computer screens. The furniture was plush and comfortable. The floors were made of cool stone or covered in soft carpeting. This was not a building as Anakin had known on Coruscant, and not a hovel as he had known all too well on Tatooine. No. Seeing this place, this street, this yard, this home, made the young Padawan even more convinced of what he had declared to Padme not so long before. That if he had grown up on Naboo, he would never leave. The next introductions were a bit more uncomfortable, but only for a moment, as Padme showed Anakin to Rui, her father, a strong-shouldered man with a face that was plain and strong and compassionate all at once. He wore his brown hair short, but still it was a bit out of place, a bit comfortable. Padme introduced Jobal next, and Anakin knew that the woman was her mother without being told. The moment he met her, he understood where Padme had gotten her innocent and sincere smile, a look that could disarm a mob of bloodthirsty Gamorrean raiders. Jobal's face had that same comforting quality, that same obvious generosity. Soon after, Anakin, Padme, and Rui were sitting at the dinner table, comfortably quiet and listening to the bustle in the next room, which included the clanking of stoneware plates and mugs, and Sola repeatedly saying, "Too much, Mom!" And every time she said that, Rui and Padme smiled knowingly. "I doubt they've been starving all the way from Coruscant," an exasperated Sola said as she exited the kitchen, glancing back over her shoulder as she spoke. She returned carrying a bowl full of food. "Enough to feed the town?" Padme asked Sola quietly, as her older sister put the bowl on the table. "You know, Mom," came the answer, and the tone told Anakin that this was not an isolated incident, that Jobal was quite the hostess. Despite the fact that he had eaten recently, the bowl of food looked and smelled temptingly good. "No one has ever left this house hungry," Sola explained.
"Well, one person did once," Padme corrected.
"But Mom chased him down and dragged him back in."
"To feed him? Or cook him?" the quick-witted Padawan retorted, and the other three stared at him for just a moment before catching on and bursting out in laughter. They were still chuckling when Jobal entered the room, holding an even larger bowl of steaming food, which of course only made them laugh all the louder. But then Jobal fixed an imposing stare over her family, and the chuckling quieted.
"They arrived just in time for dinner," Jobal said. "I know what that means." She set the plate down near Anakin and put her hand on his shoulder. "I hope you're hungry, Anakin."
"A little." He looked up and gave her a warm smile. The look of gratitude was not lost on Padme. She tossed a little wink his way when he looked back at her.
"He's being polite, Mom," she said. "We're starving."
Jobal grinned widely and nodded, offering superior glances at Sola and Rui, who just laughed again. It was all so comfortable to Anakin, so natural and so much like what he had always been wanting in his life, though perhaps he had not known it. This would be perfect, absolute perfect, except that Shmi wasn't there.
A brief cloud passed over his face as he thought of his mother on Tatooine and considered the disturbing dreams that had been finding their way into his sleep of late. He pushed the thoughts away quickly and glanced around, glad that no one seemed to have noticed.
"If you're starving, then you came to the right place at the right time," Rui said,
looking at Anakin as he finished.
"Eat up, son."
Jobal and Sola took their seats and began passing the food bowls all around. Anakin took a good helping of several different dishes. The food was all unfamiliar, but the smells told him that he wouldn't be disappointed. He sat quietly as he ate, listening with half an ear to the chatter all about him. He was thinking of Shmi again, of how he wished he could bring her here, a free woman, to live the life she so deserved. Some time passed before Anakin tuned back in, cued by the sudden seriousness in Jobal's voice, as she said to Padme, "Honey, it's so good to see you safe. We were so worried." Anakin looked up just in time to see the intense, disapproving glare that Padme answered with. Rui, obviously trying to dispel the tension before it could really begin, put his hand on Jobal's arm and quietly said, "Dear."
"I know, I know," said the suddenly animated Jobal. "But I had to say it. Now it's done."
Sola cleared her throat. "Well, this is exciting," she said, and everyone looked at her. "Do you know, Anakin, you're the first boyfriend my sister ever brought home?"
"Sola!"
Padme exclaimed. She rolled her eyes.
"He isn't my boyfriend. He's a Jedi assigned by the Senate to protect me."
"A bodyguard?" Jobal asked with great concern. "Oh, Padme, they didn't tell us it was that serious." Padme's sigh was intermixed with a groan. "It's not, Mom," she said. "I promise. Anyway, Anakin's a friend. I've known him for years. Remember that little boy who was with the Jedi during the blockade crisis?" A couple of ahs of recognition came back in response, along with nodding heads. Then Padme smiled at Anakin and said, with just enough weight to make him recognize that her previous claims about his place here weren't entirely true, "He's grown up." Anakin glanced at Sola and saw that she was staring at him, scrutinizing him. He shifted uncomfortably in his seat. "Honey, when are you going to settle down?" Jobal went on. "Haven't you had enough of that life? I certainly have." "Mom, I'm not in any danger," Padme insisted, taking Anakin's hand in her own.
"Is she?" Rui asked Anakin.
The Padawan stared hard at Padme's father, recognizing the honest concern. This man, who obviously loved his daughter so much, deserved to know the truth. "Yes, I'm afraid she is." Even as the words left his mouth, Anakin felt Padme's grip tighten. "But not much," she added quickly, and she turned to Anakin, smiling, but in a "you'll pay for that later" kind of way.
"Anakin," she said quietly,
her teeth gritted, locked into that threatening smile. "The Senate thought it prudent to give her some time away, and under the protection of the Jedi," he said, his tone casual, showing no reflections of the pain he was feeling as Padme's fingernails dug into his hand. "My master Obi-Wan is even now seeing to the matter. All should be well soon enough." His breath came easier as Padme loosened her grip, and Rui and even Jobal seemed to relax. Anakin knew that he had done well, but he was surprised to see that Sola was still staring at him, still smiling as if she knew a secret. He gave her a quizzical look, but she only smiled all the wider.
"Sometimes I wish I'd traveled more," Rui admitted to Anakin, as the two walked in the garden after dinner.
"But I must say, I'm happy here."
"Padme tells me you teach at the university."
"Yes, and before that I was a builder," Rui answered with a nod.
"I also worked for the Refugee Relief Movement when I was very young." Anakin looked at him curiously, not really surprised. "You seem quite interested in public service," he remarked.
"Naboo is generous," Rui explained.
"The planet itself, I mean. We have all that we want, all that we could want. Food is plentiful, the climate is comfortable, the surroundings are...
beautiful," Anakin put in.
Quite so, said Rui. We are a very fortunate people, and we know it. That good fortune should not be taken for granted. And so we try to share and try to help. It is our way of saying that we welcome the friendship of those less fortunate, that we do not think ourselves entitled to that which we have, but rather that we feel blessed beyond what we deserve. And so we share, and so we work, and in doing so we become something larger than ourselves, and more fulfilled than one can become from idly enjoying good fortune. Anakin considered Rui's words for a few moments. It's the same with the Jedi, I suppose, he said. We've been given great gifts, and we train hard to make the most of those. And then we use our given powers to try to help the galaxy, to try to make everything a little bit better. And to make the things we love a little bit safer? Anakin looked at him, catching the meaning, and he smiled and nodded. He saw respect in Rui's eyes, and gratitude, and he was glad for both. He could not deny the way Padme looked at her family, the love that seemed to flow from her whenever any of them entered the room. And he knew that if Rui or Jobal or Sola didn't like him, his relationship with Padme would be hurt. He was glad then that he had come to this place, not only as Padme's companion, but also as her protector. Back in the house, Padme, Sola, and Jobal were working together to clear the dishes and the remaining food. Padme noted the tension in her mother's movements, and she knew that these latest events, the assassination attempts, the fights in the Senate over an issue that could well lead to war, were weighing heavily on her. She looked to Sola, too, to see if she might find some clue as to how to help alleviate the tension. But all she found there was an obvious curiosity that set her off her balance more than had her mother's concerned expression. "Why haven't you told us about him?" Sola asked with a sly grin. "What's there to talk about?" Padme replied as casually as she could. "He's just a boy." "A boy?" Sola repeated with a laugh. "Have you seen the way he looks at you?"
"Sola, stop it."
"It's obvious he has feelings for you," Sola went on. "Are you saying, little baby sister, that you haven't noticed?"
"I'm not your baby sister, Sola," Padme said flatly, her tone turning to true consternation. "Anakin and I are friends. Our relationship is strictly professional." Sola grinned all the wider.
"Mom, would you tell her to stop it?" Padme burst out in embarrassed frustration.
Now Sola began laughing out loud.
"Well, maybe you haven't noticed the way he looks at you."
"I think you're afraid to."
"Cut it out."
Jobal stepped between the two and gave Sola a stern look. Then she turned back to Padme.
"Sola's just concerned, dear," she said. But her words sounded to Padme like condescension, as if her mother was still trying to protect a helpless little girl.
"Oh, Mom, you're impossible," she said with a sigh of surrender. "What I'm doing is important."
"You've done your service, Padme," Jobal answered. "It's time you had a life of your own. You're missing so much."
Padme tilted her head back and closed her eyes, trying to accept the words in the spirit with which they were offered. For a moment, she regretted coming back here, to see the same old sights and hear the same old advice. For just a moment, though. Truthfully, when she considered it all, Padme had to admit she was glad to have people who loved her and cared about her so much. She offered her mother an appeasing smile, and Jobal nodded and gently tapped Padme's arm. She turned to Sola next and saw her sister still grinning. What did Sola see?
"Now tell me, son, how serious is this thing?" Rui asked bluntly, as the two neared the door that would take them back into the house. "How much danger is my daughter really in?"
Anakin didn't hesitate, realizing, as he had at dinner, that Padme's father deserved nothing but honesty from him. "There have been two attempts on her life. Chances are there'll be more. But I wasn't lying to you and wasn't trying to minimize anything. My master is tracking down the assassins. I'm sure he'll find out who they are and take care of them. This situation won't last long."
I don't want anything to happen to her, Rui said, with the gravity of a parent concerned over a beloved child. I don't either, Anakin assured him, with almost equal weight. Padme stared at her older sister until at last Sola broke down and asked, What? The two of them were alone together, while Jobal and Rui entertained Anakin out in the sitting room. Why do you keep saying such things about me and Anakin? Because it's obvious, Sola replied. You see it. You can't deny it to yourself. Padme sighed and sat down on the bed, her posture and expression giving all the confirmation that Sola needed. I thought Jedi weren't supposed to think such things, Sola remarked. They're not. But Anakin does. Sola's words brought Padme's gaze up to meet hers. You know I'm right. Padme shook her head helplessly, and Sola laughed. You think more like a Jedi than he does, she said. And you shouldn't. What do you mean? Padme didn't know whether to take offense, having no idea of where her sister was heading with this. You're so tied up in your responsibilities that you don't give any weight to your desires, Sola explained. Even with your own feelings toward Anakin. You don't know how I feel about Anakin. You probably don't either, Sola said. Because you won't allow yourself to even think about it. Being a senator and being a girlfriend aren't mutually exclusive, you know. My work is important. Who said it wasn't? Sola asked, holding her hands up in a gesture of peace. It's funny, Padme, because you act as if you're prohibited, and you're not, while Anakin acts as if he's under no such prohibitions, and he is. You're way ahead of everything here, Padme said. Anakin and I have only been together for a few days. Before that, I hadn't seen him in a decade. Sola shrugged. Her look went from that sly grin she had been sporting since dinner to one of more genuine concern for her sister. She sat down on the bed beside Padme and draped an arm across her shoulders. I don't know any of the details. And you're right, I don't know how you feel about any of this. But I know how he feels. And so do you. Padme didn't disagree. She just sat there, comfortable in Sola's hug, gazing down at the floor, trying not to think. It frightens you, Sola remarked. Surprised, Padme looked back up. What are you afraid of, sis? Sola asked sincerely. Are you afraid of Anakin's feelings and the responsibilities that he cannot dismiss? Or are you afraid of your own feelings? She lifted Padme's chin so that they were looking at each other directly, their faces only a breadth apart. I don't know how you feel, she admitted again, but I suspect that it's something new to you, something scary, but something wonderful. Padme said nothing, but she knew that disagreement would not be honest. There are a lot to digest all at once, Padme said to Anakin later on, when the two were alone in her room. She had barely unpacked her things and was now throwing clothes into her bag once more. Different clothes this time, though. Less formal than the outfit she had to wear as a representative of Naboo. Your mother's a fine cook, Anakin replied, drawing a curious stare from Padme, until she realized that he was joking and had understood her point perfectly well. You're lucky to have such a wonderful family, Anakin said, more seriously, and then with a teasing grin he added, Maybe you should give your sister some of your clothes. Padme smirked right back at him, but then looked about at the mess and couldn't really disagree. Don't worry, she assured him. This won't take long. I just want to get there before dark, wherever there is, I mean. Anakin continued to scan the room, surprised at the number of closets, all of them full. You still live at home, he said, shaking his head. I didn't expect that. I move around so much, Padme replied. I've never had the time to even begin to find a place of my own, and I'm not sure I want to. Official residences have no warmth, not like here. I feel good here. I feel at home. The simple beauty of her statement gave Anakin pause. I've never had a real home, he said.
speaking more to himself than to Padme. Home was always where my mom was. He looked up at her then, and took comfort in her sympathetic smile. Padme went back to her packing. The lake country is beautiful, she started to explain, but she stopped when she glanced back at Anakin, to see him holding a holograph and grinning. Is this you? He asked, pointing to the young girl, 7 or 8 at the most, in the holo, surrounded by dozens of little green smiling creatures, and holding one in her arms. Padme laughed and seemed embarrassed. That was when I went with a relief group to Shadabi Boran. Their sun was imploding and the planet was dying. I was helping to relocate the children. She walked over to stand beside Anakin and placed one hand on his shoulder, pointing to the holograph with the other. See that little one I'm holding? His name is Nauki Tula, which means sweetheart. He was so full of life. All those kids were.
Were?
They were never able to adapt, she explained somberly. They were never able to live off their native planet. Anakin winced, then quickly picked up another holograph, this one showing Padme a couple of years later, wearing official robes and standing between 2 older and similarly robed legislators. He looked back at the first holo, then to this one, noting that Padme's expression seemed much more severe here. My first day as an apprentice legislator, Padme explained. Then, as if she was reading his mind, she added, See the difference? Anakin studied the holograph a moment longer, then looked up and laughed, seeing Padme wearing that same long and stern expression. She laughed as well, then squeezed his shoulder and went back to her packing. Anakin put the holographs down side by side and looked at them for a long, long time. 2 sides of the woman he loved. Chapter 15. The water speeder zoomed above the lake, the down thrusters churning only a slight, almost indistinguishable wake. Every so often, a wave clipped in and a fine spray broke over the bow. Anakin and Padme reveled in the cool water and the wind, eyes half closed, Padme's rich brown hair flying out behind her. Beside them at the wheel, Paddy Aku gave a laugh at every spray, his graying hair spreading out widely.
Always better over the water,
he shouted in his gruff voice, against the wind and the noise of the speeder.
Are you liking it?
Padme turned a sincere smile upon him, and the grizzled man leaned in close and backed off the accelerator.
She's even more fun if I put her down, he explained. You think you'll like that, Senator?
Both Padme and Anakin looked at him curiously, neither quite understanding. We were going out to the island, Anakin remarked, a note of concern in his voice.
Oh, I'll get you there,
Paddy Aku said with a wheezing laugh. He pushed forward a lever, and the speeder dropped into the water.
Paddy?
Padme asked. The man laughed all the harder.
Don't tell me you've forgotten,
he roared, kicking in the accelerator. The speeder jetted off across the water, no longer smooth in flight, but bouncing across the rippling surface.
Oh, yes, Padme said to him. I do remember.
After a moment of initial shock, looking from Padme to Paddy, wondering if the man was up to some dark deception, Anakin caught on and was also swept away by the bouncing ride. The spray was nearly continuous, thrown up by the prow and washing over them.
It's wonderful, Padme exclaimed.
Anakin couldn't disagree. We spend so much time in control, he replied. His mind went back to his younger days on Tatooine, pod racing along wild courses skirting disaster.
This was somewhat like that,
especially when Paddy, in no apparent hurry to reach the island dock, flipped the speeder up and down from one edge to the other, zigzagging his way. It amazed Anakin how this little adjustment, dropping into the water instead of smoothly skimming above it, had changed the perspective of this journey. It was true, he knew, that technology had tamed the galaxy, and while that seemed a good thing in terms of efficiency and comfort, he had to believe that something, too, had been lost. The excitement of living on the edge of disaster, or the simple tactile feeling of a ride like this,
bouncing across the waves, feeling the wind and the cold spray. At one point, Patty put the speeder so far up on edge that both Anakin and Padme thought they would tip over. Anakin almost reached into the Force to secure the craft, but stopped himself in order to enjoy the thrill. They didn't tip. Patty was an expert driver who knew how to take his speeder to the very limits without crashing over. It was some time later that he slowed the craft and allowed it to drift in against the island dock. Padme grabbed the older man's hand and leaned in to kiss his cheek. "Thank you." Anakin was surprised that he could see Patty's blush through the man's ruddy skin. "It was fun," he admitted.
"If it isn't, then what's the point?" the gruff-looking man replied with a great belly laugh.
While Patty secured the speeder, Anakin hopped onto the dock. He reached back to take Padme's hand, helping her stay balanced while she debarked with her suitcase in her other hand.
"I'll bring the bags up for you,"
Patty offered, and Padme looked back and smiled.
"You go and see what you can see. Don't want to be wasting your time on the little chores."
"Wasting time," Padme echoed. There was an unmistakable wistfulness in her voice. The young couple walked up a long flight of wooden stairs, past flower beds and hanging vines. They came onto a terrace overlooking a beautiful garden, and beyond that, the shimmering lake and the mountains rising behind it, all blue and purple. Padme leaned her crossed forearms on the balustrade and stared out at the wondrous view. "You can see the mountains in the water," Anakin remarked, shaking his head and grinning. The water was still, the light just right, so that the mountains and the lake seemed almost perfect replicas. "Of course," she agreed without moving. He gazed at her until she turned to look back at him. "It seems an obvious thing to you," he said, "but where I grew up, there weren't any lakes. Whenever I see this much water, every detail of it..." He ended by shaking his head, obviously overwhelmed. "Amazes you and pleases me," he said with a warm smile. Padme turned back to the lake. "I guess it's hard to hold on to appreciation for some things," she admitted. "But after all these years, I still see the beauty of the mountains reflected in the water. I could stare at them all day, every day, every..." Anakin stepped up to the balustrade beside her, leaning in very close. He closed his eyes and inhaled the sweet scent of Padme, felt the warmth of her skin. "When I was in level 3, we used to come here for school retreat," she said. She pointed out across the way to another island. "See that island? We used to swim there every day. I love the water." "I do too. I guess it comes from growing up on a desert planet." He was staring at her again, his eyes soaking in her beauty. He could tell that Padme sensed this stare, but she pointedly continued to look out over the water. "We used to lie on the sand and let the sun dry us, and try to guess the names of the birds singing. I don't like the sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere." Padme turned to look back at him. "Not here," Anakin went on. "It's like that on Tatooine. Everything's like that on Tatooine. But here, everything's soft and smooth." As he finished, hardly even aware of the motion, he reached out and stroked Padme's smooth arm. He nearly pulled back when he realized what he was doing, but since Padme didn't object, he let himself stay close to her. She seemed a bit tentative, a bit scared, but she wasn't pulling away. "There was a very old man who lived on the island," she said. Her brown eyes seemed to be looking far away across the years. "He used to make glass out of sand, and vases and necklaces out of the glass. They were magical." Anakin moved a bit closer, staring at her intensely until she turned to face him. "Everything here is magical," he said. "You can look into the glass and see the water, the way it ripples and moves. It looks so real, but it wasn't. Sometimes
when you believe something to be real, it becomes real. It seemed to Anakin as if she wanted to look away, but she didn't. Instead, she was falling deeper into his eyes and he into hers.
I used to think if you looked too deeply into the glass, you would lose yourself, she said, her voice barely a whisper. I think it's true.
He moved forward as he spoke, brushing his lips against hers, and for a moment, she didn't resist. Closing her eyes, losing herself, Anakin pressed in closer, a real and deep kiss, sliding his lips across hers slowly, back and forth. He could lose himself here, could kiss her for hours, forever. But then Padme pulled back suddenly, as if waking from a dream.
No, I shouldn't have done that. I'm sorry, Anakin said. When I'm around you, my mind is no longer my own.
He stared at her hard again, beginning that descent into the glass, losing himself in her beauty. But the moment had passed, and Padme gathered her arms in close and leaned again on the balustrade, looking out over the water. As soon as the starlight shrank back from its speed shift elongation, Obi-Wan Kenobi saw the missing planet, exactly where the gravity flux had predicted it would be. There it is, R4, right where it should be, he said to his astromech droid, who tootled in response from the left wing of the fighter. Our missing planet, Kamino. Those files were altered. R4 beeped curiously. I have no idea who might have done it, Obi-Wan replied. Maybe we'll find some answers down there. He ordered R4 to disengage the hyperspace ring, a band encircling the center area of the starfighter, with a pair of powerful hyperdrive engines, one on either side. Then he took the Delta 7 away, gliding in casually, registering information on his various scanners. As he neared the planet, he saw that it was an ocean world, with no visible landmasses showing behind the nearly solid cloud cover. He checked his sensors, searching for any other ships that might be in the area, not really sure of what he should expect. His computer registered a transmission directed his way, asking for identification, and he flipped his signal beacon on, transferring all the information. A moment later, to his relief, there came a second transmission from Kamino, this one containing approach coordinates to a place called Topoka City.
Well, here we go, R4. Time to find some answers.
The droid beeped and set the coordinates into the nav computer, and the fighter swooped down on the planet, breaking atmosphere and soaring along over rain-lashed white-capped seas. The trip across the stormy sky was rougher than the atmospheric entry, but the fighter held its course perfectly, and soon after, Obi-Wan got his first look at Topoka City. It was all gleaming domes and angled, gracefully curving walls, built on gigantic stilts rising out of the lashing sea. Obi-Wan spotted the appropriate landing pad, but did a flyby first, crossing the city and circling about, wanting to observe this spectacular place from all angles. It seemed as much a work of art as a practical and magnificent piece of engineering, the whole of the city reminding him more of the Senate building and the Jedi Temple on Coruscant. It was brightly lit at all the right places to highlight the domes and curving walls.
There's so much to see, R4, the Jedi lamented.
He had visited hundreds of worlds in his life, but viewing a place as strange and beautiful as Topoka City only reminded him that there were thousands and thousands more yet to see. Too many for any one person to visit, even if he did nothing else for the entirety of his life. At last, Obi-Wan put his fighter down on the designated landing pad. He pulled his hood up tight over him, then slid back his canopy and scrambled out against the wind and the rain, rushing across the permacrete to a tower across the way. A door slid open before him, spilling out brilliant light, and he went through, crossing into a brightly lit white room.
Master Jedi, so good to see you, came a melodic voice.
Obi-Wan pushed back his hood, which had offered little protection from the driving rain, and brushed the water from his hair.
Wiping his face, he turned to face the speaker, and then he paused, caught by the image of the Kaminoan.
"I am Ton Wee," she introduced herself.
She was taller than Obi-Wan, pasty white and amazingly slender, with gracefully curving lines, but there was nothing insubstantial about her. Thin, yes, but packed with a solid and powerful presence. Her eyes, huge, almond-shaped and dark, were sparkling clear, like those of an inquisitive child. Her nose was no more than a pair of vertical slits, connected by a horizontal one, sitting on the bridge above her upper lip. She reached out gracefully toward him with an arm that moved as smoothly as any dancer might.
"The Prime Minister expects you."
The words finally distracted Obi-Wan from his bemused perusal of her strangely beautiful physique. "I'm expected?" he asked, doing little to hide his incredulity. How in the galaxy could these beings possibly have been expecting him?
"Of course," Ton Wee replied. "Lama Su is anxious to see you. After all these years, we were beginning to think you weren't coming. Now please, this way."
Obi-Wan nodded and tried to play it cool, hiding the million questions buzzing about in his thoughts. After all these years, they were thinking that I wasn't coming? The corridor was nearly as brightly lit as the room, but as his eyes adjusted, Obi-Wan found the light strangely comfortable. They passed many windows, and Obi-Wan could see other Kaminoans busy in side rooms, males distinguished by a crest atop their heads, and females working about furniture that was highlighted at every edge by shining light, as if that light supported and defined it. He was struck by how clean this place was, everything polished and shining and smooth. He kept his questions to himself, though, as anxious to see this Prime Minister, Lama Su, as Ton Wee seemed to be in getting him there, judging from the swift pace. The Kaminoan stopped at one side door and sent it sliding open with a wave of her hand, then motioned for Obi-Wan to enter first. Another Kaminoan, a bit taller and with the distinctive male crest, greeted them. He looked down at Obi-Wan, blinked his huge eyes, and smiled warmly. With a wave of his hand, he brought an egg-shaped chair gracefully spiraling down from the ceiling.
"May I present Lama Su, Prime Minister of Kamino," Ton Wee said.
Then to Lama Su, she added,
"This is Master Jedi,
Obi-Wan Kenobi," the Jedi finished, nodding his head deferentially. The Prime Minister indicated the chair, then sat back in his own, but Obi-Wan remained standing, soaking in the scene before him.
"I trust you are going to enjoy your stay," the Prime Minister said.
"We are most happy you have arrived at the best part of the season. You make me feel most welcome."
Obi-Wan didn't add that if the deluge outside was the best part of the season, he'd hate to see the worst.
"Please,"
Lama Su indicated the chair once more. When Obi-Wan finally sat down, the Kaminoan continued.
"And now to business. You will be delighted to hear we are on schedule. 200,000 units are ready, with another million well on the way."
Obi-Wan's tongue suddenly seemed fat in his mouth, but he fought past the stutter and tucked his questions away and improvised.
"That is good news.
We thought you would be pleased."
"Of course.
Please tell your master, Sifo Dyas, that we have every confidence his order will be met, on time and in full. He is well, I hope."
"I'm sorry," the overwhelmed Jedi replied.
"Master, Jedi Master Sifo Dyas, he is still a leading member of the Jedi Council, is he not?"
The name, known to Obi-Wan as that of a former Jedi Master, elicited yet another surge of questions. But again, he put them out of mind and focused on keeping Lama Su talking and giving out potentially valuable information.
"I'm afraid to say that Master Sifo Dyas was killed almost 10 years ago."
Lama Su blinked his huge eyes again.
"Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. But I'm sure he would have been proud of the army we've built for him."
The army? Obi-Wan asked, before he could even think the direction through.
The army of clones. And I must say, one of the finest we've ever created.
Obi-Wan didn't know how far he could press this. If it was indeed Sifo-Dyas who had commissioned an army of clones, then why hadn't Master Yoda or any of the others said anything about it? Sifo-Dyas had been a powerful Jedi before his untimely death. But would he have acted alone on an issue as important as this? The Jedi studied his two companions, even reaching into the Force to gain a feeling about them. Everything seemed straightforward here and open, and so he followed his instincts and kept the conversation rolling along.
Tell me, Prime Minister, when my master first contacted you about the army, did he say who it was for?
Of course he did, the Kaminoan offered unsuspiciously. The army is for the Republic.
Obi-Wan almost blurted out,
The Republic?
But his discipline allowed him to keep a surprise well buried, along with a tumult in his thoughts, a mounting storm as furious as the one that raged outside. What in the galaxy was going on here? An army of clones for the Republic? Commissioned by a Jedi Master? Did the Senate know of this? Did Yoda or Master Windu?
You understand the responsibility you incur in creating such an army for the Republic, he asked, trying to cover his confusion. We expect and must have the very best.
Of course, Master Kenobi, Lamassu said, seeming supremely confident. You must be anxious to inspect the units for yourself.
That's why I'm here, Obi-Wan answered.
Taking Lamassu's cue, he rose and followed the Prime Minister and Tanwi out of the room. Lush grasses sprinkled with flowers of all colors and shapes graced the hilly meadow. Beyond its borders, shining waterfalls spilled into the lake. And from this spot, many other lakes could be seen about the distant hills, all the way to the horizon. Puffballs floated by in the warm breeze, and puffy clouds drifted across the shining blue sky above. It was a place full of life and full of love, full of warmth and full of softness. To Anakin Skywalker, it was a place perfectly reflective of Padme Amidala. A herd of benevolent creatures called Shaxs grazed contentedly nearby, seemingly oblivious to the couple. They were curious-looking four-legged beasts with huge bloated bodies. Insects buzzed about in the air, too busy with the flowers to take any time to bother either Anakin or Padme. Padme sat on the grass, absently picking flowers, bringing them up to deeply inhale their scents. Every so often, she glanced over at Anakin, but only briefly, almost afraid to let him notice. She loved the way he was reacting to this place, to all of Naboo, his simple joys forcing her to see things as she had when she was younger, before the real world had pushed her to a place of responsibility. It surprised her that a Jedi Padawan would be so... She couldn't think of the word. Carefree, joyous, spirited, some combination of the three.
Well? Anakin prompted, forcing Padme to consider again the question he had just asked her.
I don't know, she said dismissively, purposely exaggerating her frustration.
Sure you do, you just don't want to tell me.
Padme gave a helpless little laugh.
Are you going to use one of your Jedi mind tricks on me?
They only work on the weak-minded, Anakin explained. You are anything but weak-minded. He ended with an innocent, wide-eyed look that Padme simply could not resist.
All right, she surrendered. I was 12. His name was Paolo. We were both in the legislative youth program. He was a few years older than I.
She narrowed her eyes as she finished, teasing Anakin with sudden intensity.
Very cute, she said,
her voice taking on a purposeful, suggestive tone.
Dark curly hair, dreamy eyes.
All right, I get the picture, the Jedi cried, waving his hands in exasperation.
He calmed a moment later, though, and settled back more seriously.
Whatever happened to him? I went into public service. He went on to become an artist.
Maybe he was the smart one.
You really don't like politicians, do you? Padme asked, a bit of anger creeping in despite the warm wind and the idyllic setting.
I like two or three, Anakin replied, but I'm not really sure about one of them.
His smile was perfectly disarming, and Padme had to work hard to keep any semblance of a frown against it.
I don't think the system works, Anakin finished matter-of-factly.
Really? She replied sarcastically.
Well, how would you have it work?
Anakin stood up, suddenly intense.
We need a system where the politicians sit down and discuss the problem, agree what's in the best interest of the people, and then do it, he said, as if it was perfectly simple and logical.
Which is exactly what we do, came Padme's unhesitating reply.
Anakin looked at her doubtfully. The trouble is that people don't always agree, she explained. In fact, they hardly ever do.
Then they should be made to.
That statement caught Padme a bit off guard. Was he so convinced that he had the answers that he...
No.
She put that unsettling thought out of her mind.
By whom? She asked.
Who is going to make them?
I don't know, he answered, waving his hands again in obvious frustration.
Someone.
You?
Of course not me.
But someone.
Someone wise.
That sounds an awful lot like a dictatorship, Padme said, winning the debate.
She watched Anakin, as a mischievous little grin began to spread across his face.
Well, he said calmly, if it works.
Padme tried to hide her shock.
What was he talking about? How could he believe that?
She stared at him, and he returned the severe look. But he couldn't hold it and burst out laughing.
You're making fun of me.
Oh, no, Anakin said, backing away and falling to sit on the soft grass, hands out defensively before him. I'd be much too frightened to tease a senator.
You're so bad.
She reached over, picked up a piece of fruit, and threw it at him. And when he caught it, she threw another, and then another.
You're always so serious, Anakin scolded.
And he began juggling the fruit. Fruit.
I'm so serious.
Her incredulity was feigned, because Padme agreed with the assessment to a great extent. For all her life, she had watched people like Paolo go off and follow their hearts, while she had followed the path of duty. She had known great triumph and great joy, to be sure, but all of it had been wrapped up in the extravagant outfits of Naboo's queen, and now, in the endless responsibilities of a galactic senator. Maybe she had just wanted to take off all those trappings, all those clothes, and dive into the sparkling water, for no better reason than to feel its cool comfort, for no better reason than to laugh. She grabbed up another piece of fruit and threw it at Anakin, and he caught it and seamlessly put it up with the others. Then another, and another, until too many went his way and he lost control, then tried futilely to duck away from the dropping fruit. Padme had to clutch at her belly, she was laughing so hard. Caught up in the whirlwind of the moment, Anakin sprang to his feet and ran off to the side, cutting in front of a shack and frightening it with his sheer jubilance. The normally passive grazers gave a snort and took up the chase, with Anakin running in circles and then off over the hill. Padme sat back and considered this moment, this day, and her companion. What was happening here? She couldn't dismiss the pangs of guilt that she was out here playing without purpose while others worked hard to carry on the fight against the Military Creation Act, or while Obi-Wan Kenobi scoured the galaxy in search of those who would see her dead. She should be out there, somewhere, doing something. Her thoughts fell away in another burst of incredulous laughter as Anakin and the shack came by once more, this time with the Jedi riding the beast. One hand clenched on a fold of its flesh, the other high and waving behind him for balance. What made it all the more ridiculous was that Anakin was riding backward, facing the shack's tail. Anakin! She cried in amazement. A bit of trepidation crept into her voice as she repeated the call,
for the shack had broken into a full gallop, and Anakin was trying to stand up on its back. He almost made it, but then the lumbering creature bucked and he flew away, tumbling to the ground. Padme howled with laughter, clutching her stomach. But Anakin lay very still. She stopped and stared at him, suddenly frightened. She scrambled up, thinking her whole world had just crashed down around her, and rushed to his side.
"Annie, Annie, are you all right?"
Gently, Padme turned him over. He seemed serene and still. And then his face twisted into a perfectly stupid expression, and he burst out laughing.
"Oh!"
Padme cried, and she punched out at him. He caught her hand and pulled her in close, and she willingly crashed onto him, wrestling with fury. Anakin finally managed to roll her over and pin her, and Padme stopped struggling, suddenly aware of the closeness. She looked into his eyes and felt the press of his body upon hers. Anakin blushed and let go, rolling away. But then he stood up and very seriously reached his hand out to her. All self-consciousness was gone now from Padme. She looked hard into Anakin's blue eyes, finally and silently admitting the truth. She took his hand and followed him to the shack, which was grazing contentedly once more. Anakin climbed onto its back and pulled Padme up behind him, and they rode off across the meadow, with Padme's arms about his waist, her body pressed up against his, a swirl of emotions and questions spinning about in her mind. Padme jumped at the sound of the knock on the door. She knew who it was and knew she was safe, from everything but her own feelings. The afternoon at the meadow replayed in her thoughts, particularly the ride on the shack, when Anakin had taken her back to the lodge. For the minutes of that ride, Padme had not hidden behind a mask of denial or behind anything else. Sitting behind Anakin, her arms about his waist, her head resting on the back of his shoulder, she had felt safe and secure, perfectly content, and she had to take a deep breath to keep her hand from trembling as she reached up for the doorknob. She pulled the door back and could see nothing but the tall and lean silhouette, backlit by the setting sun. Anakin shifted just a bit, blocking the rosy glow enough so that Padme could see his smile. He started to move in, but she held her ground. It wasn't a conscious decision. She was simply entranced, for it seemed to her as if the sun was setting behind Anakin's shoulders and not behind the horizon, as if he was big enough to dismiss the day. Orange flames danced about his silhouette, dulling the distinction between Anakin and eternity. Padme had to consciously remember to breathe. She stepped back, and Anakin sauntered in, apparently oblivious to the wondrous moment she had just experienced. He was grinning mischievously, and for some reason she felt embarrassed. She wondered for a moment if she should have chosen a different outfit, for the evening dress she was wearing was black and off the shoulder, showing quite a bit of flesh. She wore a black choker as well, with a line of sheer fabric running down over the front of the dress, barely concealing her cleavage. She moved to close the door, but paused and looked back over the lake, at the rose-colored tint filtering across the shimmering water. When she turned back, Anakin was already standing by the table, looking over the bowl of fruit and the settings Padme had put out. She watched him glance up at one of the floating light globes, its glow growing as the sunlight began to diminish outside. He playfully poked at it, seeming oblivious that she or anyone else was watching him, and his smile nearly reached his ears as the globe bounced away from his touch, elongating the soft sphere of light. The next few moments of just watching Anakin were quite pleasant for Padme, but the next few after that, when he started looking back at her, his expression, alternately playful and intense, proved more than a bit uncomfortable. Soon enough, though, the pair had settled in at the table, seated across from each other. Two of the resort waitresses, Nandi and Tekla, served them their meal, while Anakin began recounting some of the adventures he had known over the last 10 years, training and flying with Obi-Wan. Padme listened attentively, captivated by Anakin's flair for storytelling. She wanted to do more, though.
She wanted to talk about what had happened out at the meadow, to try to make some sense of it with Anakin, to share with him the solution as they had shared the out-of-bounds emotions and moments. But she could not begin, and so she just allowed him to ramble on, contenting herself with enjoying his tales. Dessert was Padme's favorite, yellow and cream-colored shura fruit, juicy and sweet. She grinned as Nandi put a bowl before her. And when I went to them, we went into... Anakin paused, drawing Padme's full attention, a wry smile on his face. Aggressive negotiations, he finished. And then he thanked Tekla as she placed some dessert fruit before him. Aggressive negotiations? What's that? Well, negotiations with a lightsaber, the Padawan said, still grinning wryly. Oh, Padme said with a laugh, and she eagerly went for her dessert, stabbing with her fork. The shura moved, and her fork hit the plate. A bit confused, Padme stabbed at it again. It moved. She looked up at Anakin, a bit confused and embarrassed. But then she saw that he was fighting hard not to laugh, staring down at his own plate a bit too innocently. You did that! He looked up, his expression wide-eyed. What? Padme scowled, pointing her fork at him and waving it threateningly. Then suddenly she went for the shura again. But Anakin was quicker. The fruit slipped out of the way, and she stabbed the plate. Then, before she could scowl at him again, the shura rose into the air to hover before her. That, Padme answered. Now stop it! She couldn't hold her feigned anger, though, and laughed aloud as she finished. Anakin started laughing, too. Half looking at him, Padme snapped her hand at the floating fruit. He waggled his fingers, and the fruit looped about her hand. Anakin! If Master Obi-Wan was here, he'd be very grumpy, the Padawan admitted. He pulled back his hand, and the shura flew across the table to his waiting grasp. But he's not here, he added, cutting the fruit into several slices. Reaching for the force, he made one piece float upward and slide toward Padme. She bit it right out of the air. Padme laughed, and so did Anakin. They finished the dessert with many fleeting glances. And then, as Tekla and Nandi returned to clean up the plates, the couple retreated to the sitting area, with its comfortable chairs and sofa, and a huge warm fire blazing in the hearth. Nandi and Tekla finished and bade the couple goodbye. And then they were alone. Completely alone. And the tension returned almost immediately. She wanted him to kiss her so desperately, and it was precisely that out-of-control sensation that had stopped her cold. This was not right. She knew that in her head, despite what her heart might be telling her. They each had bigger responsibilities for the time being. She had to deal with the continuing split of the Republic, and he had to continue his Jedi training. Anakin settled back, frustration evident on his boyish features. From the moment I met you, all those years ago, a day hasn't gone by when I haven't thought of you. His voice was husky, intense, and the sparkle in his eyes bored right through her. And now that I'm with you again, I'm in agony. The closer I get to you, the worse it gets. The thought of not being with you makes my stomach turn over, my mouth go dry. I feel dizzy. I can't breathe. I'm haunted by the kiss you never should have given me. My heart is beating, hoping that kiss will not become a scar. Padme's hand slowly dropped to her side, and she sat listening in amazement at how honestly he was opening up before her, baring his heart, though he knew she might tear it asunder with a single word. She was honored by the thought, and truly touched, and afraid. You are in my very soul, tormenting me, Anakin went on, not a bit of falseness in his tone. This was no ploy to garner any physical favors. This was honest and straightforward. Refreshingly so to the woman who had spent most of her life being attended by handmaidens, whose job it was to please, and entertaining dignitaries, whose agendas were never quite what they seemed. What can I do? He asked softly. I will do anything you ask,
Padme looked away, overwhelmed, finding security in the distracting dance of the flames in the hearth. Several moments of silence slipped by uncomfortably. "If you are suffering as much as I am, tell me," Anakin prompted. Padme turned on him, her own frustrations bubbling over.
"I can't."
She sat back and struggled to collect herself.
"We can't," she said as calmly as she could. "It's just not possible."
"Anything's possible," Anakin replied, leaning forward.
"Padme, please, listen. You listen," she scolded.
Somehow, hearing her own denial brought some strength to her. Much-needed strength.
"We live in a real world. Come back to it, Anakin. You're studying to become a Jedi Knight. I'm a senator. If you follow your thoughts through to conclusion, they will take us to a place we cannot go, regardless of the way we feel about each other."
"Then you do feel something." Padme swallowed hard.
"Jedi aren't allowed to marry," she pointed out,
needing to deflect attention away from her feelings at that debilitating moment.
"You'd be expelled from the Order. I will not let you give up your future for me."
"You're asking me to be rational,"
Anakin replied without the slightest hesitation, and his confidence and boldness here caught Padme a bit by surprise. There was no longer anything of the child in the man before her. She felt her control slip a notch.
"That is something I know I cannot do," he went on.
"Believe me, I wish I could wish my feelings away, but I can't. I am not going to give in to this," she said with all the conviction she could muster.
She finished with her jaw clenched very tightly, knowing that she had to be the strong one here, for Anakin's sake, more than for her own.
"I have more important things to do than fall in love."
He turned away, looking wounded, and she winced.
He stared into the fire, his face twisting this way and that as he tried to sort through it all. She knew he was trying to find a way around her resolve.
"It wouldn't have to be that way," he said at length. "We could keep it a secret."
"Then we'd be living a lie, one we couldn't keep up even if we wanted to. My sister saw it, so did my mother. I couldn't do that. Could you, Anakin? Could you live like that?"
He stared at her intensely for a moment, then looked back to the fire, seeming defeated.
"No, you're right," he finally admitted. "It would destroy us."
Padme looked from Anakin to the fire.
Which would destroy her?
Destroy them, she had to wonder. The action or the thought?
Chapter 16.
"Wow!" Boba Fett exclaimed, rushing across the landing pad to view the sleek starfighter up close.
"Beautiful ship," Jango agreed,
strolling to catch up to his son, studying the craft with every stride. He noted the markings and design, the extra firepower, and particularly the astromech droid hardwired into the left wing, tootling happily.
"This is a Delta VII, the excited Boba announced, pointing out the rear cockpit position.
Jango nodded, glad that his son had been taking his lessons seriously.
"These were new ships, so new that they hadn't yet been fitted with hyperdrive engines," Jango realized, and he inadvertently glanced up at the cloudy sky, wondering if parent ships were up there.
He shook the thought away, turning back to Boba.
"And what of the droid?" he asked. "Can you identify the unit?"
Boba climbed up the side of the fighter and studied the markings for a moment, then turned back to his father, finger to pursed lips, an intense expression on his face.
"It's an R4P, he said.
"And is that a common droid for this type of starfighter?"
"No,"
Boba answered without hesitation.
"A Delta VII pilot would usually use an R3D. It's better at keeping the guns targeted, and the fighter is so maneuverable that handling the laser cannons is tricky. I read that some pilots wind up shooting their own nose cones off in this fighter.
They do a snap roll, coming out over and around, but they haven't compensated the manual swivel.
As he spoke, he moved his arms over each other and about, tangling them up in front of him. Django was hardly listening to the details, though he was thrilled that Boba had taken to his lessons with such energy.
"Suppose the pilot didn't need the extra gunnery skills of an R3D?" he asked.
Boba looked at him curiously, as if he didn't understand.
"Would the R4P then be a better choice?"
"Yes,"
came the halting response.
"And what pilot wouldn't need the extra droid gunnery skills?"
Boba stared blankly, but then a smile spread on his face.
"You," he blurted, seeming quite pleased with himself.
Django took the compliment with an appreciative smile, and it was true enough. Django could wheel any fighter, and if he ever had the opportunity to fly in a Delta 7, he'd likely choose an R4P over the R3D. But that wasn't what he had in mind right now. For he knew of one other type of pilot, pilots with heightened senses, who would similarly choose the better nav, but less weapon-oriented droid. Django Fett looked back up at the sky, wondering if a host of Jedi were about to descend upon Topoka City. Great racks holding glass spheres stretched across the immense room to the end of Obi-Wan's vision. Each sphere contained an embryo, suspended in fluid, and when the Jedi reached into the Force, he sensed strong waves of life energy.
"The hatchery," he stated more than asked.
"The first phase, obviously,"
Lamassu replied.
"Very impressive."
"I hoped you would be pleased, Master Jedi,"
the Prime Minister said.
"Clones can think creatively. You'll find that they are immensely superior to droids, and that ours are the best in all the galaxy. Our methods have been perfected over many centuries."
"How many are there?" Obi-Wan asked.
"In here, I mean. We have several hatcheries throughout the city. This, of course, is the most crucial phase, though with our techniques, we expect a survival rate of over 90%. Every so often, an entire batch will develop an issue, but we expect the clone production to remain steady. And with our accelerated growth methods, these before you will be fully matured and ready for battle in just over a decade. 200,000 units are ready, with another million well on the way."
Lamassu's previous boast echoed ominously in Obi-Wan's thoughts. A production center, supremely efficient, producing a steady stream of superbly trained and conditioned warriors. The implications were staggering. Obi-Wan stared at the closest embryo, floating contentedly in its fluid, curled, and with its little thumb stuck into its mouth.
In 10 short years, that tiny creature, that tiny man, would be a soldier, killing, and likely, soon enough, killed.
He shuddered and looked to his Kaminoan guide.
"Come,"
Lamassu bade him, walking along the corridor. Next on the tour was a huge classroom with desks in neat, orderly rows, and with students in neat, orderly rows. They all looked to be about 10 years of age, all dressed the same, all with the same haircut, all with exactly the same features and posture and expressions. Obi-Wan reflexively looked at the shining white walls of the huge room, almost expecting to see mirrors there, playing a trick on his eyes, to make one boy seem to be many. The students went about their studies, without paying any more heed to the visitors than a quick glance.
"Disciplined," Obi-Wan thought, "much more so than any normal children."
Another thought grabbed him.
"You mentioned growth acceleration."
"Oh, yes. It's essential,"
the Prime Minister replied.
"Otherwise, a mature clone would take a lifetime to grow. Now we can do it in half the time. The units you will soon see on the parade ground, we started 10 years ago, when Sifo Dyas first placed the order, and they're already mature and quite ready for duty."
"And these were started about 5 years ago?"
the Jedi reasoned, and Lamassu nodded.
Would you care to inspect the final product now? The Prime Minister asked, and Obi-Wan could hear excitement in his voice. Clearly he was proud of this accomplishment. I would like your approval before you take delivery.
The callousness of it all struck Obi-Wan profoundly. Units. Final product. These were living beings they were talking about. Living, breathing, and thinking. To create clones for such a singular purpose, under such control, even stealing half their childhood for efficiency, assaulted his sense of right and wrong. And the fact that a Jedi Master had begun all of this was almost too much to digest. The tour took him through the commissary next, where hundreds of adult clones, all young men Anakin's age, sat in neat rows, all dressed in black, all eating the same food in the same manner.
You'll find that they are totally obedient, Lamassu was saying, seemingly oblivious to the Jedi's discomfort. We modified their genetic structure to make them less independent than the original, of course. Who was the original? A bounty hunter named Jango Fett,
Lamassu offered without any hesitation.
We felt that a Jedi would be the perfect choice, but Sifo Dyas handpicked Jango himself.
The notion that a Jedi might have been used nearly floored Obi-Wan. An army of clones strong in the Force?
Where is this bounty hunter now?
He asked.
He lives here, Lamassu replied. But he's free to come and go as he pleases.
He kept walking as he spoke, leading Obi-Wan along a long corridor filled with narrow transparent tubes. The Jedi watched with amazement as clones climbed up into those tubes and settled in place, closing their eyes and going to sleep.
Very disciplined, he remarked. That is the key, Lamassu replied. Disciplined, and yet with the ability to think creatively. It is a mighty combination. Sifo Dyas explained to us the Jedi aversion to leading droids. He told us Jedi could only command an army of life forms. And you wanted a Jedi as host, Obi-Wan thought, but he did not say it aloud.
He took a deep breath, wondering how Master Sifo Dyas, how any Jedi, could have so willingly and unilaterally crossed the line to create any army of clones. Obi-Wan realized that he had to suppress his need for a direct answer to that right now, and simply listen and observe, gather as much information as he could, so that he and the Jedi Council might sort it out.
So Jango Fett willingly remains on Kamino. The choice is his alone. Apart from his pay, which is considerable, I assure you, Fett demanded only one thing. An unaltered clone for himself. Curious, isn't it?
Unaltered?
Pure genetic replication, the Prime Minister explained. No tampering with the structure to make it more docile. And no growth acceleration.
I would very much like to meet this Jango Fett, Obi-Wan said, as much to himself as to Lamassu. He was intrigued. Who was this man selected by Sifo Dyas as the perfect source for a clone army? Lamassu looked at Ton Wee, who nodded and said,
I would be most happy to arrange it for you.
She left them then, as the tour continued, with Lamassu taking Obi-Wan along the areas that showed him pretty much the entire routine of the clones at every level of their development. The culmination came later on, when Ton Wee rejoined the pair in a balcony, sheltered from the brutal wind and rain, and overlooking a huge parade ground. Below them, thousands and thousands of clone troopers, dressed in white armor and wearing full face helmets, marched and drilled with all the precision of programmed droids. Entire formations, each made up of hundreds of soldiers, moved as one.
Magnificent, aren't they?
Lamassu said.
Obi-Wan looked up at the Kaminoan to see his eyes glowing with pride as he looked out upon his creation. There were no ethical dilemmas as far as Lamassu was concerned, Obi-Wan knew immediately. Perhaps that was why the Kaminoans were so good at cloning. Their consciences never got in the way. Lamassu looked down at him, smiling widely, prompting a response, and Obi-Wan offered a silent nod. Yes, they were magnificent. And the Jedi could only imagine the brutal efficiency this group would exhibit in battle, in the arena for which they were grown. Once again, neither for the first nor the last time that day, a shudder coursed down Obi-Wan Kenobi's spine. For the first time, he appreciated Senator Amidala's crusade to stop the creation of an army of the Republic, and the inevitable consequence, war. A Jedi Knight, here on Kamino. The thought was more than a little unsettling to Jango Fett. The bounty hunter fell back in his seat and tightened his face in frustration. Such were the problems with working for the Trade Federation. They were masters at weaving deception within deception, and they were up to so much right now that there was no single focus Jango could determine. He looked across the room at Boba, who was hard at work poring over the schematics and capabilities of a Delta VII starfighter, and matching them up against the known strengths and weaknesses of an R4P unit. Life was so simple for the boy, Jango thought, with a touch of envy. For Boba, there was the love of and for his father and his studies. Other than those two givens, the only real challenge before the boy was in finding enjoyable things to do at those times when Jango was away or busy with the Kaminoans. At that moment, looking at his son, Jango Fett felt vulnerable. So very vulnerable. And it was not an emotion with which he was the least bit comfortable. He almost told Boba to go and pack then and there, so they could blast away from Kamino. But he recognized the danger of that course. He would be leaving without learning anything about his potential enemy. This Jedi Knight who had arrived unexpectedly. His boss would want that information. And Jango would need that information. If he took off now, after receiving a note from Tonwi telling him that he would be receiving a visitor later that same day, it would be fairly obvious that he was fleeing. Then he'd have a Jedi Knight on his tail, and one about whom he knew practically nothing. Jango continued to stare at Boba, at the only thing that really mattered. Play it cool, he whispered to himself. You're nothing more than a clone source. Well paid enough to want to know nothing about why you're being cloned. That was his litany. That was his plan. And it had to work. For Boba's sake. A wave of Tonwi's hand brought forth the chime of an unseen bell, reminding Obi-Wan yet again of how foreign this world of Kamino, this city of Tapoka, really was. He didn't give it much thought, though, for he was focused on the locking mechanism on the door before him. An elaborate electronic clasp and bolt. Quite a bit of security, it seemed to him, given the supposedly genteel nature of Jango Fett's relationship with the Kaminoans, and the obvious control the cloners held over their city. Was the locking mechanism designed to keep people out, or to keep Jango in? Likely the former, he reasoned. Jango was a bounty hunter, after all. Perhaps he had made more than a few dangerous enemies. He was still studying the device when the door suddenly opened, revealing a young boy, an exact replica of those Obi-Wan had been viewing all day. The identical one that Jango had demanded. Only this one was actually 10 years old.
Boba, Tonwi said with great familiarity. Is your father home?
Boba Fett stood, staring at the human visitor for a long moment. Yep.
May we see him?
Sure, Boba answered. He stepped back, but his eyes never left Obi-Wan, as the Jedi and Tonwi stepped across the threshold.